The context of that question that was just presented and quoted by the lawyer, the context shows us that the Jews had been involved in asking Jesus a lot of silly questions. And really, it never ceases to amaze me how bogged down sometimes you can get in the minutiae of religious questionings. They came to Jesus, and the silliest question I think they ever asked him was this one. This woman married one of seven brothers, A, and then A died, and she married B, and B died, and she married C, and then in the judgment, shall she be the husband, the wife of A, B, C, D, E, F, or G? And they went through this rigmarole, and they thought they really had him, you know. But the Jewish people were a very stiff-necked and spiritually blind people, especially their religious leaders. And I don't know whether this is always characteristic of leaders, as they're either wide awake or sound asleep, but these people were sound asleep. They had their eyes closed and they couldn't see. They couldn't see the great forest because of the little trees of tradition that they had planted and all the undergrowth of their religious arguing and bickering. You know, in a great forest, there are always little scrub oaks, and then there's some undergrowth and some vines and thicket. And I don't know of a better way to describe the Jews' religion of the days of Jesus than to say that it consisted of scrub oaks and undergrowth. And they could no more see the great forest because of these little bitty scrawny scrub oak trees and this thick mass of undergrowth. And they hoped to tangle Jesus up in some of this undergrowth. They thought that they'd fence him in with some of these little scrub oaks, you know, and build a pen around him where he couldn't get out. And then they would nab him. And Jesus Christ, with a very beautiful, deft stroke, just walked right through those scrub oaks, cleared away that path through the undergrowth, and stepped out into one beautiful clearing where there were some tremendous, giant California redwood trees. And the people looked up when he said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and strength, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And as they stood at the base of these two huge trees, Jesus Christ pointed with great pride and thanksgiving to these two as being the heart and the center of all that Christianity means and of all that religion means and the relationship between God and man. So he surprised them. He didn't let them pull him down or trap him. He didn't let them get him all tangled up in some inferior question. When they asked him, what is the greatest commandment, he genuinely told them, thou shalt love. Tonight, if I were to take the time to go into detail to show you the number of times and the frequency with which the subject of love is discussed, and the number of times that it is used in the New Testament, we'd be here all night long. And at one time I had planned to go through a good long list of references that showed you the frequency of its use in the New Testament. But I gave up. Can't do that. We don't have the time. But I do want tonight to very briefly introduce this by showing you the importance that is placed upon this subject of loving your neighbor and loving God. We studied the first one of them this morning. I want to notice the second part of this with you tonight. To give you an indication as to the important place that it occupies, I'll notice just four or five verses. For example, John 13, 34 and 35, where Jesus says, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you. He said, by this all men will know that you're my disciples if you have love one for the other. And that makes it pretty important. He said, it's a new commandment. The quality of it is going to be like my love for you. And he said, all men are going to know that you're my disciples if you have this love one for the other. That shows that it's important. When Paul was writing to the Roman Christians, he made the statement there, don't owe any man anything except to love one another. For he that loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. And then he names about four or five commandments and says, and if there be any other, it is summed up in this one word or this one saying, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Love works no ill to his neighbor. Love, therefore, is the fulfillment of the law. James calls this law, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, he calls it the royal law. He calls it the perfect law of liberty and describes it in these regal terms. And it's beautiful. The Apostle Paul told the Galatians in Galatians 5 that the whole law was summed up in one word, that word being, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Simon Peter mentions that loving of your neighbor is the result of conversion. He said, seeing that you have purified your souls in your obedience to the truth, unto unfeigned love of the brethren, love one another from the heart fervently. And then John has this to say about love. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and he who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love. And that'll give you some indication of the importance that is placed upon this subject of love. The frequency of it, I say, I couldn't begin to cover. The things in the New Testament that state how love is the core and the hub of Christianity, and how they state that it is the motivating force of all that's good on earth, and how that it has become really a well and a mainspring of refreshment, that it is actually that artesian well that makes Christianity this, what you would call, a watering place in a desert, an oasis, a green spot on a barren desert. All of these things could be said about love, and you could trace them all out and find that really love is the tap root. Love is the tap root of Christianity. But someone says, show me how important it is in relationship to other Christian graces. Well, all right, if you want to know how important it is in relation to other Christian graces, here it is. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all that I have, and if I deliver my body to be burned but have not love, I gain nothing. Nothing. Then he says, now abides faith and hope and love. Now watch him compare these. But the greatest of these is love. That's how important it is in relationship to other Christian graces. But you say, well, all right, but define love for me. Very well, listen. Love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful. It's not arrogant or rude. Love does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrong, but rejoices in the right. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. Love never fails. That's the classic description or definition of love. Would you like me to paint you a picture of love? Well, all right, I can do that. A certain man was going on the road to from Jerusalem to Jericho. And he fell among robbers, who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him he passed by on the other side. So likewise a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion, and went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own beast and brought him to an inn and took care of him. Now that's a beautiful picture of love, isn't it? So we've defined love, we've described it, we've drawn a picture of it, we've shown its relationship to other Christian graces. All of these things help us to understand what Jesus Christ meant when he said, thou shalt love, thou shalt love. And we get the impression that love is the meat on the bones. Love is that which puts shoes on, or which puts feet in the shoes. It's that which puts action into words. Puts action into the words and puts the words into action. It's that which makes theory become reality. It's that which ceases with just talking and insists on doing. This is what God means when he talks about love. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. The object of this love, he says here, is your neighbor. The word neighbor comes from an old English or Anglo-Saxon background and means nigh. The word nigh means near, and the word bur means to dwell. And it simply means someone who dwells near you. It means anyone over or whose path you cross. It means anyone in whose reach you may come. Anyone who comes within your reach or within your circle of influence, this person is your neighbor, regardless of who he is. And in the age in which we live, when communication and travel has made the world literally shrink until it sits in our backyard, you could say that really there's not much of anyone today that is not my neighbor. That's the definition of it. He is one who dwells near. Thus, anyone who is within our reach, anyone who comes within our influence, or whose path I may cross. The illustration par excellence that Jesus uses to describe the neighbor is this parable that I just read of the Good Samaritan. And in this parable of the Good Samaritan, there are two extremes, the Jew on the one end and the Samaritan on the other. And there were no extremes that were any farther apart than the Jew and the Samaritan. The Jew representing the epitome in his own eyes of all that was right and good, and the Samaritan representing the very essence of all that was wrong and bad. And here these two men stood on the opposite poles of social strata. Here they were, completely different from each other, religiously different, in every way practically different. And yet Jesus said these two men are neighbors. He says, this is your neighbor. He said, which of these proved neighbor to this man? And the men had to answer, why, the ones that befriended him. And Jesus said, you go and do likewise. This is your neighbor. So the word defined means one who dwells near us. The word illustrated is simply this, and it drives us to the conclusion that anyone whose path I may cross, who has need of me, he is my neighbor. And there's no one, really, whose path you cross that does not need you in some way or other. So be on the lookout for this man. You won't find him on the Jericho Road. You may very well find him on the street back to the dorm or on the road back to your home here in Searcy. But be on the lookout for him. He may represent or be represented by someone who has run out of gasoline. He may be represented by someone who has run out of luck. He may be represented by someone who has run out of money or run out of food or run out of friends. But whoever it may be, anyone whose path you may cross becomes your neighbor, and his need determines what you do for him. The application of neighbor to us today is simply anyone whose path you may cross. No geographical location is to be excluded, and no social strata is to be overlooked and ignored. No man, regardless of what his stand in life may be, comes outside the purview of this statement by Jesus, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Anyone whose path you may cross, who has within him the breath of life, that man is your neighbor. And if he doesn't have any in the breath of life, do the neighborly thing and bury him at least. But he's your neighbor. Treat him like you'd want to be treated. He may be different to you in religion. You know, it's hard to love people, really, who are different from you in religion. They're queer, really, aren't they? Strangest folks on earth, these people that are different from you in religion. I'm convinced that conviction produces, what would you call it? We talk about familiarity breeding contempt. I think conviction breeds contempt. I'm convinced that conviction, if it's not guided properly, is the greatest breeding ground of contempt and bigotry that you can possibly have. Conviction. And you know, many times today, people look upon conviction as being something that's equated with bigotry. They think, well, who do you think you are? You've got conviction, you must be a bigot. But that's not necessarily true. But in the book of Luke records how that when James and John and the other disciples were with Jesus going through Samaria, and the Samaritan people wouldn't accept Jesus and wouldn't let him in their homes because he was on his way to Jerusalem, James and John became infuriated. And they said, Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven and consume these people? Jesus said, he rebuked them and said, the Son of Man came not to destroy lives, but to save lives. And he rebuked this attitude. And it brings to mind this very difficult, and it's not always an accomplishment, but it's a very difficult task to have in the same heart, to have growing up in the same heart, these two plants. One plant being an unlimited commitment to truth, and the other an unlimited love for people. It's difficult to have both of those in your heart. If you're not careful, those of you who have an unlimited commitment to truth will look upon people as being just simply of no account. You'll go out and you'll damn them You'll go out and you'll read them the riot act. You won't consider their feelings. You won't consider their needs. You'll not consider when they can hear a thing and when they can't hear it. You'll just have such a burning desire to tell the truth that you'll offend a lot of people in telling it. The other person who is so sensitive to the people's feelings and their needs and so sensitive to hurting them and so so unwilling to hurt them that we'll almost sacrifice the truth in order to keep from hurting people. But to have this unlimited and unqualified commitment to truth and the unlimited and unqualified commitment to the well-being of people and their feelings, if to have that grow up in the same heart like just one beautiful tree is a very difficult and unusual quality in people. Jesus Christ had it, but unless you're careful, you won't have it. He may not have any religion, and his sins may rise before God like a stench all the way up into heaven, but you're still supposed to love him, even though his religion is different from yours. He may be different in color to you and your color. He may be different in nationality to you. I've had people of different colors come to my office and cry because of the fact that there were those in the community who just ignored them and wouldn't have anything to do with them, wouldn't even speak to them. And I've seen grown men sit in my office and cry like a baby because someone considered them to be different in color, and they were. But these people would not even speak to these people. That's sad. You know, I'm glad Jesus Christ was willing to accept people who were not the same color as he. Aren't you? I'm glad, because had he not accepted us who are different colored, none of us would be accepted tonight, because none of us is the color of Jesus. He had an olive drab skin, evidently. We don't have olive drab skin people here tonight. Drab skin maybe, but not olive drab. Nobody here tonight that's a Jew, probably. I'm so glad that Jesus Christ didn't say, now, let's stay within our own color. Let's not get off into other colors. Just leave them alone. Let them stay where they are. Aren't you glad he didn't say that? Oh, I'm glad, because had he said that, it would have meant that I could not have become a Christian. I couldn't have followed him. Had he said that, I don't know whether I would have followed him, because he would have betrayed a littleness that's not characteristic of godliness. And Jesus wouldn't have done that. Though he sinned against you, you're going to have to love him. Though he sinned against you 490 times a day, you're going to have to love him. Not necessarily in one day, but Jesus said when Peter asked him, how many times if my brother sins against me, must I forgive him? In other words, how much shall I love my brother? Jesus says, love him just without any limit. 490 times. Well, that's not what he literally meant. That's what he said. He said 70 times 7, Peter. Not just 7 times. But if he sins against you 70 times 7, you love him. Now, it may mean that you'll have to go and talk to him and say, look, you're offending me. This is wrong, and you shouldn't be doing this. But love dictates that you go to the person and talk to him and not go to everybody else and talk about him. Love will mean you go to the person. Maybe he's your enemy. Maybe the person is set out to literally destroy you. Maybe he's out to destroy your personality or out to destroy your reputation. Maybe he's out to destroy whatever you've got and to take your money and to destroy your business. What are you going to do about people like that? Well, Jesus says, love him. Love those people. Love those that are your enemies. It had become a custom to those people back there to say, love your friends and hate your enemies, or love your neighbor but hate your enemy. And they had classified anybody who's with you as your neighbor and anybody who's not with you as your enemy. But Jesus said, no, you love your enemies as well. For in doing this, you'll become the sons of your Father who's in heaven. I preached a sermon on this on October the 13th, 1963, at the Union Avenue Church in Memphis, Tennessee. After the sermon, when after the service was finished, I went back to the office, and a man followed me and tracked me down. He had been a member of the church for probably 50 years, and he came and said to me, after knocking on the door, walking into my office, he said to me, I hate that verse. I said, what verse are you talking about? He said, that one that says, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. He said, I hate that verse. Well, I was never so taken back in my life as I was that day when a professed follower of Jesus Christ simply split with the word and blasphemed the word rather than saying, it's hard for me to keep it. I have a neighbor that's obnoxious, but I love the word, but I find it so difficult to keep. He didn't say that. He said, I hate that verse. And I found myself becoming very, well, I don't know quite how to describe it. I never had anyone tell me that before. And certainly no one who professed to be a follower of Jesus Christ. Jesus said, I say to you, love your enemies. Pray for those that persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. One thought along this line is simply this, that, you know, and this was quoted and stated over in the academy last week, hate is not the opposite of love. Indifference is. Hate is not the opposite of love, but indifference is the opposite of love. And there's something to be said for that. You know, at least you recognize a person when you hate him. At least you recognize that he's there and that he is at least worthy of being hated. But a person that you just say, well, who are you? I don't even know you're around. Buzz off. Who can be bothered with you? Just indifference, total apathy toward a person. I don't know of a greater insult that you can pay a person than to just play like he's not even there. And yet we do this many times. How can we love our enemies when we fail to even love those people whose only sin against us is that they need our friendship? And there are a lot of people in the world tonight that need our friendship. They're waiting on you to take the initiative. They're waiting on you to do something because they don't seem to be able to accomplish this task, and they need you. And yet many times, because of that very need, we kind of say, well, I'm already in. What do I need you for? I don't have time for you. And we ignore them, and we treat them with total indifference. In Matthew, the 5th chapter, verses 46 and 47, Jesus said, if you love only those that love you, what reward is that? He said, if you only salute those of your own brethren, or if you only salute those that are saluting you, is what he was saying, what are you doing more than the Gentiles? Or what are you doing more than the people in the world? Do you know what he was saying here? Jesus Christ was showing us the very basis of Christianity, and he boiled it way on down, and he kept concentrating it and kept bringing it on down until finally he brought it down to this one little simple action, and I want you to see whether or not where you fit into this. Jesus said, if you only say hello to those that say hello to you, what do you more than people in the world? Now that's what he's saying. He used the word salute. And that just simply means if you say hello to only those people that say hello to you, what are you doing that the world is not doing? The world does that, he says. Now how many of you, and what he's saying is this, if you are unwilling to take the initiative in breaking down these barriers that separate people from people, unless you're willing to do that, you've never really discovered what it means to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. Now that you say, well, that puts it awfully simple. I know that. And Jesus Christ boils it down to where it comes out this one very simple gesture on your part. Are you willing to go along through life saying to people who don't speak to you because maybe they're not Christians or maybe because of some other reason, are you willing to take the initiative and say, hey, how are you today? It's a beautiful day, isn't it? Or are you always the one who never speaks to anybody and always waits for somebody to speak to you? Which one are you? All right. Jesus says here, if any man salutes only those of his own brethren, in other words, those of his own little group, what are you doing more than those in the world do? Someone said, and it's a very short poem, he drew a circle that shut me out, heretic, rebel, a thing to flout. But love and I had the will to win. We drew a circle and took him in. That's a beautiful little statement. And how true it is. It doesn't really matter how big a circle he may draw to keep you out. You can always draw a bigger one than he and take both him and his circle in and take both of them into your circle. If you want to, if you'll take the initiative. Oh, if I could get you to do one thing, that is take the initiative. I think that's the difference between a Christian and those who are outside of Christ as far as practical relationships with people. People who are followers of Jesus Christ are willing to take the initiative with people who maybe not like them, who may not even care to be around them, but you take the initiative at least and say, as much as is my responsibility, as much as lies within me, I'm going to live at peace with all men, and I'll take the initiative to do it. Well, all right, he says, thou shalt love. Then he says, who? Thou shalt love your neighbor, even though he's different in religion, even though his color's different, his nationality, even though he's your enemy or he offends you. All of these, you take the initiative and love that man or love that woman or love that boy or girl. Love your neighbor. Well, how much? As you love yourself. Uh-oh. As I love myself. You mean I'm supposed to love my neighbor as much as I love myself? That's right. That's the gospel standard. Oh, that's high. Are you able to do it? You know, our relationships with each other would be greatly improved if we'd just love our neighbor as much as we love our poodle. Yes, sir. My dog last Friday got sick. I had come home to eat dinner. Well, I saw her and she really was sick. Well, I grabbed her up quickly and I put her in the car. And if I'd had a siren, I would have opened it up going out to the veterinarian hospital to get that dog a shot. $6.50 for 2 minutes. But I wanted that dog to have it because she was my dog. She's the dog that belongs to my children. And I wanted to see that she got her treatment. And we didn't hesitate. We didn't say, well, we'll see how you come along after 3 or 4 days. And if you're still sick, we'll take you to the doctor. No, she could have been dead by then. Some of our neighbors, they don't get our help when they need it. We say, well, we'll see how after a couple of years if you're going to make it, and we'll come by and visit you then. They don't need visiting after a couple of years. They need visiting the day or so after they get to town. They need that pie or that cake or that warm open arm that says, come on in, we want you to be a part of us. If you let them go long enough, they'll die, and then you won't be bothered with them. Treat them as well as you do your dog, and you'll probably go see that their needs are met immediately. If you'd treat your neighbor as well as you treat your potted plants, you ladies, my, they'd feel like royalty. You know what you do to your potted plants tonight? You better do it for them. You better go out there and get those little darlings and bring them in the house. They'll freeze. And you won't have any potted plants if you don't. And those of you who have African violets, they just go nuts over African violets. And boy, they polish those little leaves, you know, and they open those, all that, and they feed them, and they cultivate them, and they change pots every once in a while. How nice, and that's good, but do your neighbor the same way, why don't you? Those of you men that play golf, if you'd treat your neighbor like you treat your golf clubs, your woods, my goodness, you know what you do? You go to town and you buy these little old mittens that slip down over the, you know, over the head. That's to keep them warm and keep them dry. That's right. Treat your neighbor like that and see what happens. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as you love yourself. But to love him as I love myself requires me loving myself. And those of you who have no estimate of yourself at all, if you hate yourself, you probably hate your neighbor. But if you have a genuine, healthy love and respect for yourself, measure by that your relationship to your neighbor. And Jesus said you'll have the key to real Christian living. The key to Christian living is love. But God doesn't just stop with the key. Bless his divine heart. Watch what he's done. In Matthew, the 7th chapter and verse 12, he not only gives us the key, but he tells us how to put it into the lock and how to turn it. Now, if you can imagine a God condescending to take the time to tell us not only the key, but how to put it into the lock and turn it to open up all the treasures of the Christian life. But he does. Listen to what he says. As you would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them. That's how this key of love works in the lock. He says, turn it just like you would turn it for yourself. As you would like for people to do for you, do that same thing for them. For this is the law and the prophets. And that's the same thing that he said, except in just a bit different language, in Mark, the 12th chapter, when he says, love God and love your fellow man. On these two hang the law and the prophets. He uses the same expression. And here he says, he defines this thing of loving your neighbor as you love yourself by saying, as you would have people do for you, you do so for them. This is the law and the prophets. In other words, love your neighbor as you love yourself. So we find that in this simple expression, and the one that's kin to it, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, Jesus Christ paves this road, and he laid himself down as an example of what he meant for it, by it, so we can walk right over him, right into the very heart of God. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. This is the heart of Christianity. Have you reached that yet? Oh, if we could ever get to the place where we could say, you know, I have. A girl told me the other night, she said, Brother Woodruff, I finally come to the place where I not only know what I ought to do, she says, I've come to the place where I want to do it. Boy, I thought, oh, that's it. I said, you have hit the heart of Christianity. If we can ever come to the place where we not only know what we ought to do, but we want to do it. Brethren, that's God reigning in our lives. And there's no real reigning in our lives unless we've come to that point, that we want to do what is right. Jesus here says, love your neighbor like you love yourself. He says, this is Christianity. This is what the whole law and the prophets rests upon. Well, there was a lady once, the story goes, who was walking down the street one cold winter night. And she came to this department store, and there was a little dirty, ill-clad waif of a child standing there in front of the department store with his nose pushed right up against the plate glass window, looking at a whole display of toys and clothes and shoes and apples and oranges and candy. And his shoes were so thin that there just wasn't much there. And his pants were tattered and torn. And the story says that this woman stopped there and watched him for just a few minutes until her heart just broke. And she took the little fellow by the hand and led him inside the store. And she told the owner of the store, "I want a pair of new shoes for this young man. And I want a pair of new pants and some new flannel underwear." And they dressed him out and put on him his shoes and his underwear and his pants and a good warm flannel shirt and a nice coat and a hat and some warm gloves. And she said, "Now I want you to stuff his pockets full of apples and oranges and candy." And they put then two big nice toys, one under each arm, and the little fellow was just loaded down, and his eyes just kept getting bigger and bigger, you know, with everything given him. Finally, the story says he looked up into her face and said, "Are you Mrs. God?" And you know, it makes me want to ask the question, why not ask that? Because you see, God is love. And he who abides in love abides in God. And he who loves has been born of God and knows God, John says, for God is love. And whenever we go around showing kindnesses to people, whenever we go around looking out for their needs to where we will sacrifice our rights to fill another person's need, I don't wonder that they would ask, "Are you Mrs. God?" Have they ever asked that about you? I'm sure they have, perhaps many of us. I'm sure maybe most all of us at some time or other, we've done a kindness that would make someone ask, "Are you kin to God?" But if you would go into the kingdom of God, and if you would be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect, then listen to what Jesus says. As the essence of all true religion, thou shalt love the Lord thy God. And then he says the practical application of it, that is the test of whether you love God or not in this respect, is do you love your fellow man? If you don't love your brother whom you have seen, you cannot love God whom you've not seen. The Christian life is a life of love, and if you want to devote yourself to that kind of living, I'll tell you one thing, it's where it's at. That's where the action is. And if you want to be a part of that kind of life, we extend the invitation of Christ to you. If you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and I find it very, very difficult to imagine him being anything else, then come, and if your faith is sufficient to cause you to come forward, to confess your faith in Jesus and take upon yourself tonight him and his work by being immersed into him for the remission of your sins. We offer that opportunity to you. Or if you're just a Christian already who needs some strength and who needs some help or wants to rededicate your life to a life of genuine love for other people, we offer you the opportunity while we stand and sing.
While Jesus will...